could have been a fox, but the trees were so dense it was hard to see. "Should we go?" I whispered. The rustling became louder. It was definitely a person, and we crept quietly behind a broad tree. When I turned, I saw a fat, angry-looking bald man stalk into the clearing, his whiskers grey and scraggy, a greenish stain on his shirt. With him was Mr. Slater, of all people. I always suspected he was up to no good. I wonder if Venetia knows about this. "It's old George, let's get out of here," Tom said urgently, pulling me away. As we turned, I saw Mr. Slater's face look round to us. Did he see us? We fled, our legs pounding the ground like a whirl, the bracken and dead leaves crackling under our feet, darting deeper into the wood, nipping around heavy trunks and tucking between dense bushes until all we could hear was the sound of our own rhythmic footsteps in the silent surroundings. Suddenly, as if a heavy curtain had been swept open, we tumbled out of the wood and the vast expanse of English countryside lay before us, a colossal spread of multicoloured hues bathed magnificently in the brilliant golden sunshine. We fell down, gasping for breath, laughing, checking behind us for the shadow of old George on our trail. But there was nothing, only the light whisper of the leaves as a breeze lifted them to and fro, and the songs of the birds flitting busily around the edge of the greeny gold field of wheat before us. "We'd better go home," I said. "You know where to find me?" Tom said, helping us up. "At the hop picker's huts." And with that he turned and began a wide-strided walk down the hill to the river. "Bye," Sylvie said quietly, which meant that she liked him. And I had to admit, as we picked up our picnic basket and headed home, that it was rather fun having an adventure of our own. As we trotted around the edge of the wood, I asked Sylvie if she'd ever seen anyone sneaking around the wood.
"Proggart," she replied.
"Proggart? Where?"
"In Pease Potter, behind trees, in the pixie ring, down by Bull's End Brook," she said quietly in her taut Czech voice.
I know she disappears off by herself quite a lot, but I never knew she'd been wandering all over the countryside.
"He meets men," she added.
"What kind of men?"
"Just men," she glanced away. "Boring men."
"Were you scared?"
She shook herself up, running ahead of me with bravado.
"No."
As I sped up behind her, I remembered where I had heard the name Allicott Farm. It's a place on the other side of Lichfield. Mrs. Gibbs started selling their honey in the shop last month. I wonder how old George came across his assortment of goodies, how Mrs. Gibbs got her hands on it, and how exactly Mr. Slater was involved.
I have decided not to inform Venetia quite yet. Let her come crawling to me. Or, better still, keep it tucked away for a time when it might be put to good use.
Telegram from General Winchester to Colonel Mallard. Monday, 27th May, 1940. Operation Dynamo is underway. All civilian boats sent to Dunkirk to collect 300,000 British and French troops stranded on beach. All local facilities, military and medics, on standby.
Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Wednesday, the 29th of May, 1940. Who'd have thought such a disaster could happen, and that I would be caught up in the midst of it? Tonight I am in Dover, working fast to patch up the soldiers coming off the boats from Dunkirk. Hundreds of thousands of troops, surrounded and trapped on a beach in France, the Luftwaffe strafing them with bullets. And all we can do is get everyone who has a boat to go off and rescue them, from fishing boats to ferries and yachts even. It's as if we've gone back to medieval times. Dover is a mass of activity, teams of men pouring off boats of all shapes and sizes, and tramping through the town to the railway station. Most of them, thank goodness, seem to be in good humour, overjoyed to be home. But many others look like they've been through a nightmare. Then there are those on stretchers, bleeding and delirious, or silently dying. The thick mess of fresh blood, fresh casualties, is relentless in our surgery, an old workhouse converted into a hospital, reeking of human death, lightly confused by the acidic stench of sterilization. The medics are too few for so many brutally wounded men, but we are trying our best, working from one patient to the next with gruesome practicality. They picked me up at dawn in a bus packed with available doctors and nurses from the area, and we're here for a few days at least. It's now well past midnight, and I'm sitting in a dusty back room with an hour off to catch whatever rest I can. They've set up a few beds, but every time I close my eyes, all I see is blood and gore, and I can still hear the screams of men as the pain gets too much, or worse, the sudden disconcerting quiet of death. I'm trying not to think about David, but it's like a throbbing beacon at the back of my brain. I know he was in France, almost all our troops were, so he must be somewhere in this chaos, I hope. We have some desperate cases here. Earlier today, I was called to help a bloody mess of a young officer by the name of Barclay, who had a vast gash of shrapnel in his side. I quickly realized that it was too late for surgery, too late for anything. His bleeding was relentless, spurts pulsating into the drenched poultice that I pushed desperately into his ribcage. "You're going to be all right. You'll be just fine," I said softly. "I'm going to die, aren't I?" he murmured, his refined tones sounding very young indeed. He must have been just out of school, the same as David. "No, you'll be fine," I lied, inwardly panicking. What should I do? Should I tell him he's going to die, in case he has something he needs to say? I felt so utterly unprepared. What was I doing here? What was I playing at? "If," he stammered quietly, "if I die, will you give my ring to someone?" He tried to raise his hand, and I saw the gold band loose on his finger. "Of course," I said, slipping it off and holding it out in my hand. It was a man's signet ring, heavy, old, valuable. "Give it to Carrington," he murmured, his voice breaking as he spoke the name. "In Parnham, near Lichfield." "That's close, I can get it there," I said gently. "Is there a message?" "Say, I love you," he choked horribly. "Of course I'll give it to her," I said. "He's her man," he whispered, his eyes looking into mine, large with dread, scared that he'd asked too much, said too much. He could be hanged for this, if he wasn't dead already. A surge of blood rushed to my face. I've never met a homosexual before. I'd heard of them, of course, but always thought they were different, living in an underworld, as if they didn't really exist at all. But here was a gentle, handsome, dying youth, telling me to send his last message to his friend, who he loved. I was speechless for a moment, unravelling the dense mesh between morality and reality. "I'll tell him," I whispered. Then, as if something had suddenly occurred to him, he opened his eyes wide and gasped, "You won't? You won't hand him in, will you?" "No," I said, meeting his gaze. "You can trust me."
I wasn't thinking. I forgot that I could land him in trouble. I couldn't bear for anything to happen to him. His lean body began to shudder with tears. I wanted to wrap my arms around him, but I couldn't take my hands away from the thickening maroon of blood flooding the dressing. All I could do was find his hand and squeeze it tight. "You're the brave one," I said. "You're the hero. Carrington will be fine. Don't worry about him. Just rest and breathe easily." And his breath became easier and easier until it stopped. I looked around for help.
someone to tell, someone to acknowledge this death. But no one was there. They were too busy. Another life just begun and already over. A faraway star glows brighter and then disappears into the void. What an insignificant, unprepared army of souls we are.
Letter from Flight Lieutenant Henry Brampton Boyd to Venetia Winthrop. Airbase 9463, Dawes Hill, Buckinghamshire. Tuesday, 4th of June, 1940. Dear Venetia, my darling, I can't tell you how incredibly hard we've fought these last weeks, keeping the Luftwaffe from bombing the men being rescued at Dunkirk. The last boats left today, and we flew wearily back to base to celebrate our successes. And my name has been bandied around as something of a hero, no less. Our dogfighting happened mostly inland, heading off the Luftwaffe before they got to Dunkirk, and it wasn't until the fourth day that I went after three Messerschmitts into the fray, shooting them all down. They're making a tremendous fuss about it back here at the base, even though I keep insisting it was nothing. I will be home on leave in a month or so, and I've asked Mother to arrange an engagement celebration of sorts. I can't wait for our honeymoon, my dearest, when you will finally be mine. All my love, Henry.
Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Wednesday, 12th of June, 1940. Nothing for ages, and now we're right in the midst of war. Dunkirk was astounding. We rescued almost all the British troops, and most of the French troops too. Far more than anyone had hoped. Everyone says it's all thanks to the little ships. All those ordinary people dropping everything to hurry off in boats and pick up our soldiers off the beach. Daddy took his yacht over and says he saved over 300 soldiers.
Bombed all the way, he says.
He has been incredibly pleased with himself, with people lining up to shake hands in the village square.
We small boats were central to operations, he told a gathering. We could go right up to the beach, carry the men to the big ships in deeper waters, ready to head for England. It was a fearful scene. Crowds of men crawling the beach like ants, wading into the water, sometimes up to their shoulders, while overhead Nazi planes strafed us with bullets. I'll never forget hauling those men out of the murky water. Some badly wounded, all exhausted, the bullets pummeling the choppy sea around us.
Luckily, David Tilling came home all right, although exhausted and starved. Mrs. Tilling was incredibly relieved and kept him in bed for 2 days to recover. Fortunately, the colonel gave up his room and has taken a hotel room in Lichfield, or I think we'd have had a war right here in Chilbury. Ralph Gibbs from the shop came back in a bit of a state, with his shoulder dislocated and some broken ribs. He is prone to fighting, and we can't help wondering if his injuries were from the enemy or from trouble in the ranks. He gets to stay at home for now, while David Tilling has to go back again in a few weeks, probably heading to North Africa. And very unhappy he is too, mooching around trying to woo Venetia, who is far too busy with Mr. Slater to even notice him. Henry is a hero at last, and bound to get a medal, Mrs. B says. He downed three Nazi planes over Dunkirk. I was hoping he'd have leave too, but they're busy helping poor France, who are being overrun. Sadly, the son of Mrs. Poultice, one of the sewing ladies, didn't make it. He was in a small boat that was bombed by a Nazi plane. Another boat dragged him out of the water, but he was too injured and died before they reached Dover. She hasn't spoken a word since, just slowly sews. We managed to convince her to join the choir, which might help a little. Mr. Churchill says we're not giving in. Daddy's glad that Mr. Churchill became Prime Minister, even though a lot of people say he's wrong. They want to make a settlement with the Nazis rather than fight, as frankly our chances don't look terribly good.
They're cowards, Daddy roared. It's more honourable to go down fighting than to give in. We can't just let them walk all over us.
Mr. Churchill says this war is going to be fought in the air, and we've been asked to give our pots and pans to the government so that they can be melted down and made into bombers. I found 11 in our kitchen, which
surely must amount to a wing at least. Invasion. If we don't give in, we're the next ones after France to be invaded. Since Chilbury's only 7 miles from the coast, there's a chance we'll be overrun by Nazi troops before we've even heard about it. We'll be woken in the middle of the night by the sound of tanks crashing down our doors. What will happen if we get taken over by the Nazis? We'll all starve as they'll take our food to give to Nazi soldiers. They'll take anyone left who can fight and send them to the front line. Or get shot. They'll force the rest of us into factories, even children like me. We'll have to have Nazi soldiers staying at our houses, or shoving us onto the street so they can live there. We won't be able to go anywhere except by walking or bicycle, as they'll take our motor cars and we won't be able to get on trains. They'll imprison or shoot anyone who doesn't do what they say. They'll imprison or shoot anyone they don't like. People have started moving away. The Duns have gone to Wales, as Lizzie is deaf and Hitler doesn't like children like that. The synagogue where we take Sylvie is looking rather empty, as many Jewish people are moving away from the coast, even though the synagogue is determined to stay open for the Jewish people and the troops. We're petrified about Sylvie, of course. Mama wanted us to go and stay with a cousin in Scotland, but Daddy refused.
I have complete confidence that we'll always remain British, even if those Nazis try anything silly.
He looked all gruff and proud, thwacking his horsewhip against the unsuspecting leg of an armchair, and I felt at once glad to be part of such a fearless national spirit, and frightened to death that it's no help at all when you have half a dozen Nazi guns pointing at you. Everyone's going mad accusing people of being spies. They've rounded up all the Germans and Italians and sent them to camps on the Isle of Man. Even Mama's frightfully nice bridge partner, Mrs. Barone. I can't imagine her in a camp at all. Where would she store all her fur coats and fancy hats? We've been told to look out for spies amongst us, keep an eye on our neighbours and turn in anyone doing anything suspicious. I considered telling someone about Proggart, as he's forever sneaking around. I even found him in Daddy's study last week, leafing through a few papers, telling me he was trying to locate a lost cufflink. But Daddy would beat me if they carted off Proggart. He's got to be the last available butler this side of London. We've been told there'll probably be Nazi planes coming over to drop bombs on us soon, and the vicar's taken the job of air raid warden. Most people have dug great holes in their gardens to put in Anderson bomb shelters, which are little metal huts that look far too flimsy to survive a bomb. I'm glad we've got a cellar that's big enough to sleep in, even though it's thick with dust and home to a highly prolific spider community. The government has circulated leaflets about what to do when the Nazis invade. Stay calm. And what we're not to do. Panic and run away. There are pictures of Nazi soldiers and a list of what to do if we find one. Go to the police. And what not to do. Try to reason with them and get shot as a result. We've been busy removing signposts so that when they arrive, at least they won't know where they are. Apparently the rest of Europe was overrun easily because the people weren't prepared and they simply panicked. I'm not entirely certain how the government intends us to stop a cavalry of well-equipped Huns, but this is what they have told us to do. Preparation for invasion. Keep calm. Don't run away. Don't believe rumours and be distrustful of orders. Check that orders are from the government. Hide all maps, food, fuel, tools and other supplies. A parachutist will prey on you for these items. Put concrete pillboxes, landmines or barbed wire defences on beaches, fields and roads. Dig anti-tank ditches on roads and tracks. A line across the country stops the Nazis from going north. Block the roads with motor cars and other big obstacles, or by felling trees. If necessary, use wire or chains to block a road with an imitation bomb. Box with cable. Only ring church bells to warn of invasion. Form a group of local defence volunteers from men still in the village. Daddy is organising the few men left. Form a village invasion committee to work out how your village aims to defend itself. The Chilbury Invasion Committee, CIC. Mrs. B has taken it upon herself to coordinate the CIC.
Everything is abbreviated nowadays because it sounds more official. She's been especially bossy as her remaining servants have left, so now she's fending for herself, asking for recipes from Mrs. Tilling, although we suspect she's living off hampers sent down from Claridge's. She called the WVS ladies for a special CIC meeting in the village hall this afternoon.
As your leader, I feel it as my duty to prepare our ladies for the coming invasion. First of all, I'd like some suggestions of what we can do if a troop of abominable Nazi thugs stomp into the village square tomorrow morning.
But we don't know it's going to happen for certain, do we? Mrs. Gibbs stammered. A haunted look has overtaken her face since Ralph's been back. I'm not sure if she's more scared of Ralph or the Nazis. Mrs. B marched up to her, putting her face close like a sergeant major.
We have to be ready, she roared.
Then, turning to the rest of us, she continued,
I'm looking for serious suggestions.
I'd get my husband's old air rifle, Mrs. Tilling suggested. I don't know how to use it, but it would look good, wouldn't it?
Well, you must learn how to use it, Mrs. B shouted. Everyone who has access to firearms, clean 'em, make sure you know how to use 'em, then load 'em.
She looked around menacingly.
Mrs. Quayle, what about you?
I'm quite dapper with a kitchen knife, she said confidently. And I exchanged a smirk with Hattie, who was rocking Rose's pram. Imagine Mrs. Quayle getting cross with a vicar over tea and whipping out a carving knife. Mrs. B, clearly disappointed with our lack of pluck, demonstrated how to lunge and attack using household objects, such as a fire poker, a table lamp, or a three-tiered silver cake stand.
We all enjoyed it thoroughly and left feeling awfully brave.
Of course, the next meeting wasn't as straightforward as that, because the Chilbury Defence Volunteers, CDV, showed up halfway through. The Chilbury Defence Volunteers, CDV, versus the Chilbury Invasion Committee, CIC. Daddy has taken it upon himself to start the Chilbury Defence Volunteers, CDV. We think he did it because Mrs. B stole the CIC from under his nose, and he needed a troop of his very own. The Chilbury Defence Volunteers consists of a motley collection of men left in the village, preparing to defend us if or when the Nazis come. All a lovely idea, but in reality it's Daddy, Proggart, old Mr. Dawkins and the two farmhands, some other old men in various stages of decay, the vicar, Ralph Gibbs, although he has yet to put in an appearance, and would you believe it, Mr. Slater, who apparently finds the entire thing rather amusing, according to Venetia. They meet twice a week and Daddy shouts a lot while they pretend to be a real army, marching up and down and trying to stab each other with pitchforks, since they don't have any proper weapons yet. The problem is that Mrs. B's invasion committee also meets in the church hall twice a week, and yesterday the men began arriving with their pitchforks just as Mrs. B was perfecting her three-tiered cake stand lunge, surrounded by a group of women practicing the very same move.
Point! Lunge! Thrust! We're supposed to have the hall now, Daddy announced pompously. Will you clear your women out of here immediately?
I shall do no such thing, Mrs. B retaliated,
swinging her cake stand in his direction.
We have important invasion preparations.
Daddy was starting to raise his voice.
Get your blasted women out of here.
Brigadier, I'd like to remind you that my invasion committee is the most important body for invasion prevention in our village. As you can see, we are in the middle of crucial combat practice.
But we've booked the hall, haven't we, Vicar?
He turned and searched for the Vicar, who was hiding behind Mr. Slater, and dragged him by the collar to the front.
Haven't we, Vicar?
Well, yes, but the hall is meant for all of us to share.
Never mind that,
Mrs. B said, pushing the Vicar roughly to one side.
We were here first, and you'll have to wait until we're finished.
In that case, we'll have to come in and take over.
He turned to the group of men, who were starting to edge back towards the door, and bellowed,
Company, fall in!
The men shuffled into the room amongst the women and got into line, pitchforks at attention. The women just stood and looked at them in dismay until Mrs. B yelled,
Point! Lunge! Thrust!
The women obediently lunged, mostly at the men who were in the way,
which was clearly Mrs. B's intention. Mayhem ensued. Many of the older men and women made an escape to the door, some nursing injuries. But the rest continued for a few minutes until the door slammed shut and a sharp, teacher-like voice clicked.
"What's going on here?"
Everyone looked around. It was Hattie, standing at the door with her blue pram. "What on earth are you all doing?"
"The Brigadier started it," Mrs. B began. "It's our rightful turn to use the hall, and they barged in and tried to intimidate us."
She looked proudly around at the ladies.
"But we showed them, didn't we?" "It was our turn and they wouldn't leave," Daddy said,
nose in the air as if even discussing it were beneath him. "Well, I suggest that everyone put down their weapons and shake hands," Hattie said. "And then after that, let's put on the wireless and listen to news of a real war." Everyone quietly began putting things away. Although Mrs. B snapped,
"That's precisely what I've been telling them to do all along."
Bad news for the choir and my singing career. The choir competition has been postponed indefinitely. Prim announced it at practice, although she quickly said we'd have a special choir practice next week and everyone in the village is invited. At least I still have singing lessons. Prim has lent me a pile of modern records for me to try to sing along to at home. Some are jazz, which is quite thrilling. We're to try them out in our singing lessons. Tonight at choir practice, we sung an especially aggressive rendition of Jerusalem, becoming quite raucous towards the end as we're so peeved with the Nazis for preventing us from singing in St. Paul's Cathedral. You'd have thought that our higgledy-piggledy assortment of ladies was ready to pick up handbags and charge towards the enemy. Does Hitler have any idea of the force and determination of 13 impassioned women? At the very least, I suspect he's never considered the lethal potential of a 3-tiered cake stand.
Note from Miss Edwina Pawtry to Brigadier Winthrop. 3 Church Row, Chilbury, Kent. Monday, 17th June, 1940. Dear Brigadier, after waiting more than a month for the money owed, which is rightfully mine, I have taken it upon myself to remind you that we had a deal, and you owe me the second half of my money. I carried out my role, and now you must fulfil yours. I will be waiting at the outhouse Saturday morning at 10. Miss E. M. Pawtry.
Notice pinned to the Chilbury Village Hall notice board, Monday the 17th of June, 1940. There will be a special choir practice on Wednesday evening in commemoration of those lost in Dunkirk. It will be open to all the village, both men and women. Prim. Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Wednesday the 19th of June, 1940. We arrived early for Prim's special choir practice, some chattering about what Prim had for us, others with our own thoughts after Dunkirk. I had convinced one of the sewing ladies, Mrs. Poultice, to come. She lost her only son at Dunkirk. She hasn't spoken a word since, just sews in her own world. I was surprised that so many people were there. The whole of the Chilbury Ladies' Choir, the sewing ladies, and some other women not in the choir. Then there were men, too, including the vicar and Mr. Slater, and even Colonel Mallard. I tried to ignore him, but he insisted on coming to speak to me. Fortunately, as he came near, the heavy door swung open and Prim came down the aisle, and we were saved the need to speak to each other. Instead of her usual dramatic voice, Prim gestured for us to be quiet. Tonight is a special evening for us to come to terms with what has happened and what is upon us. Please take a chair from the back and bring it to the altar, making a circle. We all did so. I had poor Mrs. Poultice beside me, looking so pale and sad, as if something inside her had stopped living, but her body lived and moved like a lifeless machine. "In my youth," Prim began, "I travelled to Italy, and it was there that I learnt a different type of song, a song to bring peace and acceptance of the natural cycle of life and death. The chant. She put out her hands on either side. Let us take each other's hands. Complete the circle. We gingerly held hands. Such a simple, childish thing, but so rare in our busy, untouching world. I felt the back of Mrs. Poultice's wrinkled, veined hand in mine, and felt her tremble slightly with the strange intimacy of it all. It was as if we'd torn down our everyday masks to expose the scared children inside. Now, let's close our eyes and start with a single held hum. The sound of a faint hum, a middle note neither high nor low, emanated from Prim, at first soft, and then growing with confidence. Then I heard Kitty's soft tones joining in, then Mrs. Quail's, and before long a sonorous single note was echoing around us, filling all the gaps between us with a vibrating connection, a noise that drowned out all the mess. The hum petered out, thinning into the air, until it was a whisper, or an echo of a whisper. After a few poignant moments of silence, she handed out some music. "This is a simple Gregorian chant," she told us. "It is for the mourning of the dead." She hummed the note to begin, and then we all came in, Kitty's voice leading the descant. It was beautiful. At the end, when the echoes had faded into silence, we sat a few moments in the warmth of the silence, our hands linked. Prim was the first to get up, ushering everyone to follow suit, quietly taking her chair to the back, finding her music bag. "Keep calm and peaceful for the rest of the night," she said gently, and drifted out as if on a wave of calm. We slowly began to get up, chattering softly amongst ourselves. Even Mrs. B. seemed pacified for a moment.
"What an extraordinary evening," she said. "I really wasn't sure at the beginning, but it was like we were nuns," she chortled.
Funny how a bit of singing brings us together. There we were in our own little worlds with our own problems, and then suddenly they seemed to dissolve, and we realized that it's us here now, living through this. Supporting each other. That's what counts.
Sylvie's Diary. Wednesday, 19th of June, 1940. Everyone is sad after Dunkirk. Prim had a special choir practice with chanting. I sat beside Kitty and Mrs. Poultice. Her son died at Dunkirk. Her hand shook, so I gripped it tight. Then we sang a Gregorian chant. It was beautiful. I began to cry. It made me think of sitting shiver when Grandpa died, and there was chanting every evening. Mrs. Poultice was crying, too. The Nazis will be here soon. Mrs. Winthrop will hide me in the attic. When they came to Czechoslovakia, they found everyone who hid. They beat people in the street. They took that screaming woman into a house. Then she had blood and cuts nearly dead. I try not to think, but it is there. I sang Kitty our morning chant, the Kaddish. She wrote it down. Maybe we can sing it for Mrs. Poultice.
Letter from Miss Edwina Poultry to her sister Clara. 3 Church Row, Chilbury, Kent. Saturday, 22nd June, 1940. Dear Clara, all is not yet lost, Clara, although I must confess we have had a few setbacks, the first entailing the Brigadier handing over the rest of the money. I met him at the outhouse today, fuming he was, and he told me he wasn't giving it over. "Why not?" I demanded, clutching my black bag, ready to give him a good clout.
"Because, my dear woman, you were terribly good at covering your tracks, were you?"
He was all controlled anger, waiting to snap like a tethered wolf. I felt my knees wobble, but put up a good front. "No one knows a thing. I did a clean job, always do."
"And what about the rumours?"
He took a step closer, threateningly, so I took a step back right into the nettles. I could feel them pinch under my stockings.
"Mrs. Chilling has been asking my wife questions about the birth. Couldn't you have come up with something better than the mechanical ventilator? A different problem for the other child?"
"I don't think you understand the difficulties of the task, Brigadier," I said haughtily. "We made a deal, did we not? And I fulfilled my part, so I want my money."
"I told you there'd be no money if you arouse suspicion. If that woman pieces it together because of your carelessness, then you'll be paying me," he snarled, his face coming up to mine like a fierce army general, "with your blood."
The smell of his breath at such short range made me fall over backward into the bracken, and he looked smugly on as I picked myself up and pulled off twigs. He's a woman-hater, that man. I can tell one anywhere. In my line of business you hear all sorts of stories from women, sometimes even the men themselves thinking they're so clever abusing some poor woman. I can tell the Brigadier thinks women are only good for serving men and having babies. And sex, of course. Doesn't realise that we're human too, with heads and hearts and pockets to line.
"You never catch on," I said. "It'll blow over same as everything. You owe me that money and I can raise a stink about it if you don't give it to me. You know better than to make a fuss about something that'll put you in jail," he said shrewdly, twiddling his moustache. "But I'll make you a deal. If I hear no other gossip before the end of the summer, you'll have your money. Until that time, I expect no more stupid blunders, no more rumours, and no more notes. I'd have thought you'd know better than to pass letters between us. You could have had us both arrested within the hour if it had fallen into the wrong hands." He shoved my note, all scrunched up, into my hand and stormed off, leaving me picking bracken off my skirt and feeling relief about two things. First, that the Tilling woman didn't know anything for sure, and second, that I'd just have to sit tight and the rest of the money would be making its way to me soon. Not ideal, but better than only getting half. My next problem was that stupid girl Elsie. She came to my house, thinking she had won over me.
"I know your deal," she said, striding in and lounging on my sofa like a sleek cat. "And I want my cut. Whatever are you talking about?" I said, smiling with puzzlement. "Your deal, swapping the babies. I know all about it."
"What on earth are you talking about, my dear?"
"Don't act all nonchalant with me. I saw you swap 'em. I know you did it and got paid."
"Who could possibly have asked me to do that?" I said, all astonishment.
"The Brigadier. See, I've been thinking, putting it together. I'm not as stupid as I look, you know."
"Believe me, Elsie, you look far cleverer than you really are." She ignored my comment or didn't understand it.
"He gave you money so he could have his son, didn't he? And I want my cut."
"But you didn't do anything," I said, deciding to get down to business.
"I helped you escape with one of them. In any case, I know all about it, and I can tell people. Isn't that enough? I want £200, please."
She stuck her hand out towards me, face up, all white and skinny like a corpse's. "How do you know how much he gave me?"
"A woman like you wouldn't have done it for less than 20,000.
I grimaced. I knew I should have asked him for more. "I'll give you 50, and that'll be that. If I hear you've told anyone, you'll have to pay me my dues," I added, taking a leaf from the Brigadier's book and looking all menacing. "With your own blood." I left the room and got out the large notes. Wretched girl. I knew I should never have trusted her. Anyone capable of fooling around with Edmund Winthrop was bound to be immoral. I slapped them on her hand and she leapt up.
"You'll have no worries from me. I'm heading out of this dingy place as soon as I've finished some business here. The Brigadier can stuff his stupid job. No one wants to be a maid these days, and it's easy to see why. I've been slaving for them pennies, and now I've got my chance."
She glanced at the money bulging in her old coat pocket.
"Now I've got the money, I'm getting a new life. I got myself Edmund, didn't I? So now I'll get another one of them toffs. Once one of them gets a taste of Elsie, I'll have him eating out of my hand. Just you watch. Next time you'll see me, you'll hardly recognise me."
With that, she flounced out, and I thought how stupid the girl was. If she couldn't hold down an idiot like Edmund Winthrop, she'd have no hope with anyone even slightly sensible. Still,
I do wonder who she has her eye on. So, Clara, for now, I'm stuck in this village like a splodge of sour tar, unable to move until I get the rest of the money, trying desperately to ensure the nasty secret doesn't leak out. Burn this after reading it, and I'll be in touch soon. Edwina.
Letter from Venetia Winthrop to Angela Quayle. Chilbury Manor, Chilbury, Kent. Wednesday, the 3rd of July, 1940. Dear Angela, you will never guess what happened here yesterday. I'm hoping it won't cause any commotion, but I think it's terrifically funny. It all started yesterday evening at Alistair's house. It was around midnight, just as they were closing up the bar at the Fox and Ferret. I could hear the men's voices in the square. They'd become much rowdier since the soldiers came home after Dunkirk. Ralph Gibbs has been causing trouble, I've heard, giving someone a bloody nose last week, and threatening someone else with a knife. They say he's become involved in the black market. When I arrived yesterday evening, Alistair had cooked me dinner, would you believe it? Baked cod, no less. He'd laid the small table and found a pink rose from somewhere, one of those floppy perfumed ones put in a jam jar with water. "Where did you learn to cook?" I asked. "Here and there," he smiled, again not giving anything away. "I'm glad you approve." He brought a candle over to the table and watched me in the flickering glow. "Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could do this every night?" "Yes," I said, "but tediously I have to dine with my family most evenings." He grinned. "Actually, I only know two other dishes, so we'd be out of options by the end of the week." We laughed, and he tidied a piece of my hair behind my ear, stroking my cheek and my neck. "I'd love to have you here always," he said, gently. "You could let your hair down. Let me see the real you, the real Venetia, not the showy one who pretends to be mischievous and confident." He smiled, but there was that disarming seriousness about him again, a look of intensity behind his eyes. I pulled away, uncomfortably. "But that's who I am," I said, serenely, although I'm not sure if it really is any more. After dinner, we went to the sitting room. He'd lit a few candles and dotted them like glowing stars around our dark little studio, their waxy scent filling the air, all warm with velvet cushions and the deep, thick rug. I stripped naked and posed for my portrait as usual. It's astonishing how one gets used to having no clothes on, bearing one's all for the sake of art. The portrait has been coming on very nicely, even though Alistair stops every few moments to come and whisper sweet nothings in my ear. But tonight, as he was close to putting on the finishing touches, there was a sharp knock at the door, or rather a bang, like someone was using their fist.
"Slater, I know you're in there,"
a rough voice shouted. I knew instantly who it was, as did Alistair, as we both exchanged looks, and I smirked.
"Open this door, Slater,"
the voice growled, slurring from drink. It was David Tilling. He was clearly worse for wear from a few pints at the pub, and looking for some kind of retaliation. Since he returned from Dunkirk, he's been bragging about how he'd made it back, as if he were some kind of hero, which of course he's not when you think about Henry shooting down three Nazi planes in a single day. David has an embryo RAF moustache, which looks ridiculous, and he's taken up smoking. It's too hilarious. He found out about my affair with Alistair after following me around. Alistair and I spend all our free time together, such as our newfound love. Since then, David's been making these snide little comments, such as,
"Slater's not good enough for you, Venetia. What are you doing with a coward?"
Or the rather damning,
"You're letting yourself down, Venetia."
I can only conclude that he's learned a lot more in the army than just fighting. He'd never have come out with something like that before he left. Back to last night when he was banging on the door. Alistair put his brush down and went leisurely into the hallway, pulling the sitting room door closed behind him. I slipped my dress back on, without putting any underwear on first, which was rather naughty, don't you think?
"Ah, good evening, David,"
Alistair announced as I heard the door opening.
"What brings you here?"
I want a word with you, Slazer.
David slurred loudly, sounding so young and foolish next to Alistair's poise. After this, there were a few loud bangs, as if someone had been hit, and the clank of something hitting the ground. I was worried, as David is tall and just back from army training. He must have thrown a few punches at Alistair. I peeked into the hallway, but there was Alistair, not a hair out of place, holding David in a kind of vice grip, a broken beer bottle lying on the floor, which I can only assume was David's. I found myself looking at Alistair with renewed awe. Where did he learn those combat skills?
"I'm not entirely sure what it is that you want, David,"
Alistair said lightly.
"But trying to bottle me is not a good means of communication."
"I know she's in here, Slater."
David's voice was getting louder.
"Get out of my way!"
Next thing I knew, he had bombarded past Alistair and was bursting into the sitting room, where I now sat, good as gold, perched on the sofa, my hands together in my lap, my green floral dress delicately creased, and a small smile on my lips. "Hello, David."
"Venetia?"
he said, dismayed, his big floppy mouth gaping open. I can only wonder how dazzled he'd have been if he caught me with no clothes on. He came up to me and sat beside me, taking my hands in his.
"Venetia, I need to see you. I'm leaving tomorrow."
He was drunker than I thought, his hands moist and clammy, his breath virtually toxic.
"I wanted one last kiss, since you're giving yourself to every man in the village."
I slapped him, although not hard. I knew it was just another line he was trotting out. "David, I can be with who I want. You need to learn that no one owns me, especially with this war going on. We all need to be ourselves, free." I laughed as I said it. I'm no more free than he is. Alistair has me completely smitten. Suddenly, David lunged for me, trying to kiss me, his flabby lips like a cold fish slurping me up.
"David, please stop!"
I cried. Alistair pried him away from me, and David stood and turned to punch him. But Alistair ducked, sending David flying over to the other side of the room, completely off balance, crashing on the floor in the corner. Then he turned and saw the picture.
"My God, Venetia,"
he gasped, gazing up at it flabbergasted. I remained perched on the sofa, as if butter wouldn't melt in my mouth, as Alistair dashed over and covered the easel with a large black sheet.
"Done from imagination, I hope you understand,"
Alistair said lightly, trying to hide a compulsion to laugh.
"Venetia, you are posing new for this scoundrel."
He got up and whisked the black sheet away, taking it all in. The curves, the... well, I'll leave the rest to your imagination, Angie. Suffice to say, he saw it all. "It's art, David," I said simply, shaking my hair back in a nonchalant fashion. "It's what artists do."
"You took your clothes off for this bastard,"
he snarled, his face set in a reddening grimace.
"You let him paint you. You let him touch you, didn't you?"
"David, I'm a grown woman."
"And I'm a grown man."
He stood looking from me to the portrait in seething silence. "David, I know you're leaving tomorrow, but you need to go now. This is Mr. Slater's house. You can't just go around barging into people's houses like this."
"I'll tell your father,"
he broke in decisively.
"He'll have Slater's guts for garters."
His strangled laugh came out somewhat awkwardly.
"He'll put a stop to him."
"Don't tell him, David." This was getting out of hand. Daddy would kill Alistair. And probably me, too. "I know you won't betray me like this." He looked me in the eye, and then his eyes travelled down my body, and I felt he was groping me in his mind, lifting my dress, his hands all over me. Then, quick as a flash, David grabbed the picture and was out into the cold midnight air, slamming the door shut in my face as I raced out after him. I yanked it open and ran into the darkness. But the blackout had him out of sight in seconds. Alistair came alongside me, and we darted around the village green trying to listen for his escape route. But he'd vanished. I never thought he'd be so extraordinarily daring, or so incredibly fast. Our search ended when I tripped over a rock and went tumbling down towards the pond, surprising a few snoozing ducks.
"Are you all right?"
Alistair whispered, coming up beside me. But before he could utter another word, I dragged him towards me, and we began kissing right there on the village green. What would Mrs. B say to that, do you think? So we never found David, who disappeared off to war this morning. I wondered if he'd have had time to run over to show the painting to Daddy, but he evidently didn't, as Daddy hasn't murdered anyone. In any case, he'd be risking his own life by being the messenger. Daddy can be a lunatic with a shotgun. Remember what happened to that poacher last year? I don't know what David would have done with my portrait, as it would have been too big to take with him, and he certainly wouldn't have left it at home for Mrs. Tilling to stumble across. Perhaps he gave it to someone for safekeeping, and I'm hoping it's not someone who knows me like Ralph Gibbs. Meanwhile, I've been begging Alistair to tell me how exactly he has all this defense training, but he always changes the subject. The more I get to know him, Angie, the more I think he's up to something. There was a surprising incident after church on Sunday, on the path outside, where everyone always gathers. Alistair was there. He says he loves to come and hear us sing in the choir, and Mrs. B rushed up to him.
"You must let me introduce you to people,"
she insisted, taking him around her flock. The thing is, when they got to Colonel Mallard, I saw him hold back slightly.
"I really need to be getting on, Mrs. B,"
he said, all politeness backing away.
"Don't be ridiculous," Mrs. B boomed. "You need to know everyone here if you mean to make some money, eh? What?"
She nudged him, chortling. The odd thing was that Colonel Mallard also seemed uncomfortable. He was in no mood to meet Alistair, so when Mrs. B inevitably pulled them together, the scene was a little awkward, to say the least.
"How do you do?"
they both said together, and then there was nothing for a long moment.
"Lovely weather, wouldn't you say?"
Alistair began. But could I have been correct? Was he amused at something? His lips smiled in their usual polite way, and his upright stance was relaxed as ever, and yet there was a trace of humour in his voice. It was as if they had met before, and not under these circumstances.
"Probably won't last,"
Colonel Mallard seemed to sneer at him, then turned quickly and found important things to discuss with the vicar, baffling as that might seem. Does Alistair know Colonel Mallard? And if so, in what capacity? It was also terribly perplexing. So I decided to ask Hattie what she thought when I popped in for tea after church. "What do you know about the colonel who's staying with Mrs. Tilling?" "He's tremendously rude, according to Mrs. Tilling, and hardly manages a conversation with her," she said. "But she's barely civil to him, especially since he had the audacity to offer her a lift home from Lichfield last week. It was pouring with rain, and he stopped next to her on her bicycle and practically forced her into his car," she giggled. "Can you imagine the tension in the air as they drove home?" "But he did give his room up to David when he came back. Went to stay in a hotel in Lichfield. Although she tells me that's only what was expected." She shrugged. "If you ask me, they're tripping over each other, neither ready to call a truce. Why do you ask?" "He had a peculiar exchange with Mr. Slater, as if they know each other, and not necessarily in a nice way. It makes me wonder if he's doing something illegal, like the black market." "Oh, dear," she began, looking down. "I meant to tell you earlier, but I wasn't sure how to put it. I was up with Rose the other night, and I saw him leaving his house at 2 in the morning. He strode off over the square. Heaven knows what he was doing."
"Are you sure?"
"I couldn't believe it was true."
"When did he come back?"
"I didn't see him come back, although I was up until 3. She rearranged Rose in her arms. "Venetia, he seems to be always popping out. and now Colonel Mallard is awkward around him. It does seem to indicate that he's up to no good. But everyone else in the village adores him. He put up the tables for the jumble sale last week. Mrs. Quail was in a complete state before he came. And he's also been helping the sewing ladies transport their balaclavas to Litchfield in his car. And you know how he helped Sylvia home after she came off her horse by Bull's End Brook. She thinks he's wonderful. But what was he doing by Bull's End Brook in the middle of the afternoon? It simply doesn't add up, Hattie said. Maybe he's just dabbling in the black market a little, saving himself a bit of money. That would be fine, but he seems positively rolling in money, with the motor car, the fine clothes, or the presents he gives you. Maybe he's selling his paintings, I tried. Mrs. B has always been keen to get her hands on his works of art. Are any of them gone? No, I shrugged, feeling the fight drain out of me. He hasn't sold so much as a sketch to Mrs. B. Avoids her if he can, and all his paintings are still in his portfolio. Except the one that David Tilling stole, I thought, and Lord knows where that is. It doesn't bode well, does it?
No, I'm sorry, Venetia, Hattie said.
I sat feeling rather sorry for myself for a while, then pulled myself together. Well, there's nothing else for it, then. I'll have to follow him.
Oh, Venetia, it might be dangerous. Why don't you see if you can find out other evidence before you do that?
Hattie asked. We discussed it at length, and she persuaded me to ask some more questions. Give it one last try. I promised I would, but it seemed so hopeless. When I'm with him, everything seems perfect, and I feel such an idiot for even doubting him. But then, when we're apart, and all these strange things come up, I can't help but wonder, who is he? I must be boring you senseless, dear Angie, so I'll leave you there and write again soon with any more news. I know you think I should move on to my next victim, but Alistair is truly the man for me, even though I'm not exactly sure what kind of man he is. I'll write again as soon as there's news. Much love, Venetia.
Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Saturday, the 13th of July, 1940. Today I took the bus to Parnham to give Berkeley's ring to Carrington. I've been putting it off for weeks, and honestly wish I hadn't been so quick to promise I'd do it. I didn't even know who Carrington would be, or indeed which Carrington, should there happen to be more than one. But I knew I had to go, now that the Nazis have started bombing the ports. Dover was smashed last week, buildings in piles on the ground and people dead. It won't be long before they're upon us and we'll be prisoners in our own country, not allowed to travel, and forced to work incredibly long hours. I try not to think of it, as it scares me to death. On the bus I thought it all through. I've never known any homosexuals, apart from now Berkeley, of course. I suppose I've always thought it's a phase or something, some adolescent crush gone on too long. Harold used to say there was something wrong with them, and I wondered what kind of a man I was going to meet. How he would react. I hoped he wasn't dangerous, as you can never tell, especially if there really was something wrong inside. What ridiculous situations this wretched war has put us in. What was I thinking, agreeing to it? I changed buses at Litchfield, heading out to Parnham, and found myself seated next to an extremely talkative lady who was clearly the village gossip. This was a terrific stroke of luck, if vaguely annoying, and I asked if she knew where I could find Carrington. "Why, didn't you know? He lives in Parnham House, Viscount Carrington, if you please," she joked, putting on a posh accent. "Oh, I didn't know," I said, not finding it the least bit funny. That's all I needed, a viscount. "Is he a young man?" "No, but there's two sons." The eldest is away with the RAF, bit of an upper-class snob. Then there's the younger one, leg-wounded in France, at home recuperating. He's a nice lad. Doesn't seem to get on with the Viscount, though.
The Viscount is his father, right?
Yes, she sniffed. Very proud and traditional. Doesn't like the way the boy hangs about. If you ask me, he can't stand the sight of him. She pursed her lips, nodding in a most